So yeah, so this is how to learn anything and teach JavaScript. It should apply generally to learning stuff and programming. I'm just focusing on JavaScript because that's my area of expertise and it's the thing that I can talk most credibly about. So I'm Jan. I'm a front-end engineer. I used to be a curriculum manager for a company that runs boot camps all across the country. One of them is actually here at U of A. They're still going on here, both in web and data visualization, or they might be called data science here, I'm not sure. But also I taught one of those courses for 6 months right over in the medical school building. I like to say that I used to teach in the medical school at U of A, and I'll put my contact info up again in the end. So up until December, I was a full-time RVer, which means my fiance and I were traveling around the country in a motorhome. That was our home for nearly 2 years. And a lot of people are like, oh, what's that like? It must be like being on vacation all the time, and sometimes it is. Sometimes it looks like this, and it could be really great, but also sometimes it looks more like this. So in 1999, so almost a 20-year-old motorhome, you take on some risks and it breaks down sometimes. So it can be an adventure in great ways and in terrible ways. And this one time we were, I kind of just showed the punchline, but this one time we were, we broke down on the side of the road. We were trying, we had some cooling issues. We had it in for maintenance recently and they weren't able to find anything. And we finally overheated and had to stop as we were going to try to take it to a Freightliner to get looked at. And called AAA. They said that a tow truck that was big enough for the RV wasn't going to be there for about 4 hours. So we put the leveling jacks down, turned on the generator, turned on the air conditioner, and did what anybody else would do. Unhooked the Jeep, went on a beer run, and turned it into a Corona commercial. So we hung out for a while. It was a pretty fun day. But then when later on when the tow truck driver finally got there, his name was Pops, and later as I was riding in the tow truck with him, he would give advice on relationships and like relationship advice with stuff like when you're arguing with your partner, you should always have the last word, and that word should be sorry. So kind of one of those guys. But he'd driven millions of miles in a truck trailer doing long haul trucking. So he'd seen a lot of stuff. And as he was hooking up the RV to the tow truck, he was at the front and he sniffed and said, "You got a busted heater core, just leave them cooling out of there." And it turned out he was right. Like people had seen it, done maintenance on RV. We had no clue what was wrong with it, and he figured out what was going on because he smelled something specific in a specific spot. On a diesel pusher, the heater core is up there, and the engine's all the way in the back. So the only reason that you'd have a cooling smell up the front is heater core. And that's kind of what I want to talk about a bit today, is when expertise looks like magic. When everybody who's programmed has had the experience of working on a problem for a long time, and you're just beating your head up against it, and somebody comes up, looks at your screen, and says, "Promise not all takes an array," or something. But it almost feels like they go up and they smell your code, and they immediately know what's wrong. So what I want to focus on today is three questions. What is expertise? How can we develop expertise for any given skill? And how can we help someone else develop expertise? I'm focusing on JavaScript because, once again, that's what I can speak most credibly about, but the same principles are going to apply to just about anything that you are an expert in that you want to be able to teach to somebody else. So how did I end up here and focus specifically on this whole learning and teaching thing? Well, I have way too many hobbies. So that required a lot of getting better at learning, so I could pick up new ones when I got bored of old ones. There's one time early on in my career that I worked with a lot of programmers who did not study computer science, who felt like they were missing out, and so I volunteered to teach a workshop. My boss said, cool, you have an 8-hour day to do it. I was like, hey, can I have 2 4-hour days? No, it's great, 6-hour day it is. So I found myself very quickly overwhelmed by the question of what do I fit into a day for a crash course in computer science? So I kind of actually had to learn how to learn so I could learn how to teach. So I had to really sort of go back in time and think, well, what are the things that I got out of my degree or learned during my degree that helped me in my day-to-day? How did I get there? And how do I communicate that to others? Then for a while, like I said, I was a professional educator, so it kind of moved that direction. And I'm a serial quitter, so I'm no longer a professional educator. Number one, what is an expert? Are there any computer science folks in bachelor's degree? Okay, cool. So I'm going to put this definition to you that an expert is someone who can find the root cause of the problem in Big O log n time. So what things happen in Big O log n time? Anybody have a guess at what I'm trying to get at here? A data structure. So what I'm looking for here is a binary tree. So a complete balanced binary tree. Worst case for finding any node is Big O log n, because that's the height of the tree, which is kind of, when I taught my crash course, that was actually my big moment that I was trying to build to the whole day, because I think that's the coolest visual picture of Big O that you can get. It's like, oh, it's the height of the tree, you can see it right here. But anyway, so the reason that I use this as my kind of working computer science-y definition of an expert is an expert is somebody who has an extraordinary amount of information, and they can categorize it and find any given piece of it very quickly or very efficiently. So it's not just the breadth of knowledge they have, but the way they organize it and they think about it and they're able to use it to apply to a problem. So if you've ever had car trouble and you aren't a car person, when you imagine your car, it might look something like this in your mind. Whereas somebody, a really good mechanic, might think of it more like this, kind of like a flowchart. Maybe also drawings of individual systems that they can then kind of zoom in on. But really a lot of the way an expert thinks is like troubleshooting, or in debugging terms, bisecting, splitting problems into pieces, throwing away as much information as possible at any given time, ruling out very likely things quickly, or ruling out unlikely things that are easy to test for, or really just splitting things into pieces. So to get there, we kind of have these three steps. This is one model of how learning happens. We build knowledge, so that's the kind of amassing of facts that a lot of people think of when they hear the word learning. Then once you have those facts, you begin forming mental models, making connections between things, keeping mental representations in your head, and then finally forming a testing hypothesis, so using those mental models to think of new information and apply them to new problems. So building knowledge. So when you're first starting to learn a program and you see something like this, you might think of it like this. So you've got a for loop, you've got an I starting at 0, you keep going as long as it's less than or that length, you have one die each loop, so list of things. And this is, when I was teaching programming class, this is basically how everybody read code at the start. When I'd ask someone to talk me through what their code was doing, this is how they talk. And that's how people tend to think when they start. The program is those individual, very kind of syntax-focused things, hard to see the bigger picture. Now, when you start forming mental models, you might think more like, I'm iterating over an array, copying it to a new array, and creating some of those numbers. And more importantly, as you're forming mental models, this is the really powerful thing that lets you do. You already see that we're iterating over an array. And when we're looking at the inner part, we kind of get to forget that. And we don't have to constantly keep that in our mind. Now this effect is even more exaggerated when you have a very large file. We don't just split things into functions for reusability, we split things into functions so we can turn those bits of behavior into pictures in our head. We don't have to think about all we're doing other things. And then finally, forming testing hypotheses, you might, this is where I think expert level programmers, I think part of the reason refactoring is really satisfying is because you're really doing some of this, like, oh, couldn't I do this a different way? And you see if you can do it a different way. So maybe I could do this with map and reduce. You start seeing those patterns, seeing that that's equivalent to another thing, or testing, maybe finding out you're wrong. The reason this is all really important is that our short-term memory is very limited. Most people can have 5 to 7 things in their head at any given time, just in short-term memory. If you're really lucky, you might go as high as 11. But beyond that, that's about your cap for short-term memory. Oh, I gotta not look at the screen for that. So one way we can get around this is by assigning meaning to things. So this is a list from a memory course I took. Think like in middle school. It's called tree list because it starts with tree and it goes tree, light switch, stool. Wait, tree list. Did I already mess it up? Stool. All right, stool, table, glove, gun, dice, ice skate, cat. I always forget 10. I'm gonna skip 10 for right now. Goalpost, egg, witch. Oh goodness, I'm having a tough day today. 15's paycheck, 16, no, it's 14 candy. Anyway, 17's magazine, 18's 18 wheeler, 19 is golf club, 20 is semi truck. That's new. usually, volleyball, oh my gosh. And ring, okay, I missed ring. Bowling ball. Oh, candy was 6. All right, cool. Anyway, so point here, that's actually fine because the point here is not, hey, look, I can do a parlor trick. But if you look at this list, you'll start to see some patterns emerge. So cat and 9, that's a pretty clear one. Table has 4 legs, stool maybe has 3 legs. Club has 5 fingers. 19th hole at a golf course is the bar. But it's about assigning meaning to this. And you can actually go a little further with the you can actually go a little further with the tree list and do some really cool things with it. Like if you want to, once you have this encoded, you can actually say memorize a 20-item grocery list by associating pictures with each of these things. So if you have to get asparagus, you might think of like a glove that is asparagus fingers or something like that. But just like very visual things. So it kind of lets you get around that. And in the same way, forming mental models, mental representations, writing functions, drawing pictures of a system, the way they let us deal with information is they let us understand it, hold it in our memory, organize it, and most importantly, make decisions with it. And that's from Peak, which is one of the like most important probably books on learning science. The researcher that Malcolm Gladwell misquotes with the 10,000 hours figure is one of the authors of that. And that's where deliberate practice was coined, was by that author. So if you've ever heard of that, we'll talk about that more shortly, but. Yeah, so most important thing, mental models take advantage of long-term memory. That's what we really need. Anybody watch Sherlock? And so we see this another way. When he has the whole mind palace, that's a real memory technique. Some people use an actual house that they've lived in. Some people use location. Some people actually create a memory palace. And some people use commute. If you do the same commute every day, that's actually one of the easiest ways to quickly develop this technique, and you're able to You're able to place things you want to remember at each of your turns or each landmark along the way. So that kind of that is one of the ways we can remember a lot more by taking advantage of the way our brain works with reading. Now, you don't need this to be an expert, but it kind of works in the same way. Like, you start remembering pictures of things and models of things, and you can get beyond that 7-item maximum. And so when it comes down to it, to truly understand something is to find meaning in what you're learning. And all these tricks, but also mental models, let us associate meaning with large amounts of information. And in Learn Better, which is a really solid book, I'll have a reading list that I'll share after this, Orrit Boser talks about how you have to move beyond facts. Learning facts isn't enough. When you're really engaging in learning, you understand relationships, you know, cause and effect, analogies and similarities. Ultimately, we have to shift how we think. And really, I think this is one of the things that gets me really excited about the scientific process versus the scientific method, is that it's a whole way of thinking and analyzing. And I like to sit when I'm talking to people that are not super science literate, I like to say, well, science is the practice of believing that everything is possible until shown to be very, very unlikely. So it's a way of classifying information, not a way of being certain all the time, but a way of thinking about things in a way that we can use them. Now, a really important thing here is developing expertise requires assigning the right meaning. And in some areas, mental models are well-defined. In some areas, they're not. But you can actually, as we kind of conceive with flat earth thinking, you can come to a very good understanding of a system that doesn't act, that does not reflect reality. So you can become kind of an anti-expert almost. So how we get there is through practice. And most people, so this is straight out of Pete, this example. When most people hear the word practice, what they kind of think of is, okay, I want to get good at tennis. Maybe I take a couple lessons. Then I play enough with friends until I start to feel good about it, and I can play games. And now all I'm doing is playing games with friends, and my serve hasn't gotten any better. I haven't gotten any better. Backhands, like, I've plateaued. I'm not getting any better. And you're just doing kind of the thing that's fun. So that's what a lot of people think of practice, and it's got pretty hard limits on it. Now, to upgrade that a little bit, you can do what's called purposeful practice, which is you're breaking some stuff down in pieces, and you're saying, I'm going to work on my serve today. And you set aside time to work on your serve. And this is a lot of, this resembles a lot of what real pretty effective self-taught learners tend to do, people who self-teach instruments. Oftentimes, people have had music lessons, and they go to learn a new instrument. That it'll resemble more purposeful practice than practice. They might break out of a plateau maybe. But you can actually go one step further and do what's called deliberate practice, which is, so it's specific subtasks that are well-defined. You're spending all your time practicing in a very uncomfortable space, like going outside of your comfort zone, doing something that's not necessarily enjoyable, because you have to do that to build new skills. You're giving full attention to the test that you're doing. You're getting regular feedback. You've got a very tight feedback cycle. Ideally, that's coming from an expert, but you can replicate it as long as you've got something, as long as you've got practice tests that you know immediately whether you've done them right or not and how to adjust. So once again, what is an expert? An expert is somebody who can categorize and use a lot of information effectively by leveraging mental models, mental representations of things. Number two, so how do we develop expertise in this skill? Well, we talked a little bit about purposeful practice, but the actual journey, so this is probably my favorite model of the different stages of learning, of competence. There's Birch's stages of competence. And we have these four areas. We have unconscious incompetence, where you don't know what you don't know, to conscious incompetence, you start to know what you don't know, to then you start to know what you know, and finally, you start to forget what you know in unconscious competence. And for a long time, this is kind of what an expert was thought of as. Yes.
Are the extremes of this the Dunning-Kruger effect?
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that this would be in the C also on the Dunning-Kruger effect of the GDP page. Yeah. So it's exactly. So this is either so the I could do that. That someone who's maybe never painted thinks when they see a painting. And the I could never do that, that a lot of people think when they look at someone coding, they're coming from a similar place.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then of course the other stuff where you get an imposter syndrome. And then that's actually, we'll talk a little bit about how teaching can actually help fight imposter syndrome. But yeah, so really if expertise doesn't just look like you get to the end. Expertise, or at least continually developing expertise, kind of goes between those last two things. But we'll get back to that. So this can be looked at. So each of these arrows can kind of be looked at as a stage of learning, and this is kind of a simplified model. If you're looking for a very practical book for rapidly acquiring skills, First 20 Hours by Josh Kaufman is probably the best one you're going to find. It doesn't overdo it on the like underlying causes, and it really just like lays out. If you want to become a really fast learner, that's the book to check out. First 20 Hours comes from the idea that first 20 hours of learning any skill are going to suck really badly, but there's going to be very little to no reward during that time. So how do you make sure that you don't make it last a lot more than 20 hours and that you take full advantage of it and you get those quick wins very early and that you are going to get to the end of it. So the cognitive or early stage is when you're understanding what you're trying to do, you're researching, thinking about process, breaking things down into manageable pieces. Then the associative or the intermediate stage, practicing, noticing environmental feedback, and then adjusting your approach based on that feedback. So that's that thing that can be a lot easier when you have a teacher, but you can kind of do it on your own. And then finally, the autonomous or the late stage is performing the skill effectively without paying too much attention to detail. And so, yeah, like I said, we can kind of map those to each of these. And a really important thing here is we don't want to get to the autonomous stage so we never have to think about it. The reason that it's really important as an expert that's continuing to grow and learn, that you want to get to that autonomous stage and reach that kind of unconscious competence area, is it allows you to focus on the next individual detail rather than every small part of the process. So once you have a basic understanding of how to program, learning a new language is now just learning that new language. You're not also learning how to think about programming. If you want to learn, say you already know JavaScript, you want to learn React, you aren't learning two things at once, or you want to do something even more detailed, you want to learn Redux. By being at the autonomous stage, you're kind of the dependent things for that next individual small skill. You're able to focus on learning that last skill, repeating these learning phases without being bogged down in all the distractions of the things that you're still learning how to do. And so I'm going to kind of go through these next couple slides quickly because I'm never going to ask you to actually read and absorb more things than you can hold in short-term memory. But these are just two ways to think from the first 20 hours, 10 steps of rapid skill acquisition, and actually there's also the 10 principles of effective learning from the same work. So once again, really pretty solid book for learning how to learn better, but I'm going to simplify it even further by pulling from 4-Hour Chef by Tim Ferriss. So Tim Ferriss wrote 4-Hour Body and 4-Hour Work Week, which I think his masterwork is 4-Hour Chef, and it's the one where he's trying to do the least selling to you. But Tim Ferriss is a true lifelong learner. He's done things like go from not dancing to winning a salsa world championship, something like that, in 6 months. So he's really obsessed with learning, and that's part of actually how how he ended up writing The 4-Hour Chef. And the first chunk of the book is about how what he calls meta learning works. And so he breaks stuff down into this is how to break things down so you can learn. And this is kind of the underlying processes of it. If you don't know how to cook and you've always wanted to learn how to cook, the best book that you could get is 4-Hour Chef. I've cooked for a very long time. It's one of the things I messed up. And I can't recommend this book enough. If you've cooked for a long time and you want to learn a few more things, you should get 4-Hour Chef. If you want to learn how to learn, you should get 4-Hour Chef. I think anybody can get something out of 4-Hour Chef. Now, I'm going to just ask you to think to remember three things to focus on for learning, because I think these are the three non-optional focuses, is prep, practice, and your mental state. So prep is doing your research, figuring out what outcomes you're shooting for as you're learning, making sure you're choosing the right ones. Then the practice focus area, you don't want to do what's hard, like what doesn't feel good. You want to choose tasks where you can tell whether you did it right or not. You want to constantly be forming theories about what's going to come next. And finally, mental state. First 20 hours really emphasizes like 20-minute bursts of practice. I think for a lot of things, that's not practical. Programming is one of them because it's more like a freight train than a sports car. But you do want to take breaks. You want to stay humble, but you also want to stay positive. And that's a really kind of tough balance to strike. Very tough balance to strike. But really important thing here is that fun practice is really good practice. If you've ever worked on a musical instrument, the guitar is like the kind of really low-hanging fruit for me to guess that in any given room, somebody has attempted to learn guitar if they haven't successfully learned guitar. But early phases of it, once you learn your three chords, you play a lot of songs and it feels really good, and you might not learn anything else for a few months because now you can play guitar. But no amount of playing those three chords over and over again is going to help you learn a fourth chord, a bar chord, or learn how to improvise. We do want to get to the part that's fun and rewarding, but it's important to remember that the fun, rewarding stuff comes because of the stuff that isn't as fun. Another thing to remember is passive tasks, like reading, watching videos, taking information. That's in the prep phase, not the practice phase. I think this is especially hazardous with people who are learning the program. There are so many books and so many videos, and it can feel really good to like read something about programming and get it, like understand what you're reading, and it feels like you're learning, or watch videos and be like, yeah, I can feel that. But those are not practice. Now, they're still important. I'm not going to say people shouldn't read books or shouldn't watch videos, but I did have to do a lot of when I was teaching, telling people that's, you got to stop and you got to write some code. You got to write some code wrong. You got to feel confused about your code. You got to fix it. But you have to actually do the thing to get good at the thing. It's intuitive if you use the example of basketball or any physical thing. No amount of watching videos of someone shooting free throws is going to make you or give you a good free throw percentage the first time you pick up a basketball. No amount of watching video of someone playing guitar is going to let you pick up a guitar and play guitar. Same applies to coding. Same applies to pretty much any skill-based thing. And then everything sucks until it doesn't. So once again, not that it's never going to be fun, but that it's not going to be fun for a while. And I think part of the staying motivated through the stuff that's really hard is remembering that part that sucks, that frustrating area, that is where the learning is happening. It is not happening, like you are not building new skills when you feel really good and comfortable. If you're lucky, you'll figure out a way to feel rewarded as you're uncomfortable, but it will never be like easy while you're learning a skill. So how do we develop expertise in a skill? We want to do the correct kind of practice, prep, practice, and take care of your mental state. Then finally, how can we help someone develop expertise? And once again, JavaScript is an example. You should be able to apply these principles to a lot of different things. So teaching is one of the ways that you actually can move back to conscious competence. So I recommend some form of teaching to most people who are at an expert level. If it's super unappealing to you, like, you know, fun, if you're gonna hate teaching, you might not get much out of it, but it's a really good way to kind of get back into that conscious competence and to remember the journey of how you know what you know now and how that applies to what other people, the journey other people are going to go through. The other thing I'd say for people in tech environments is giving technical interviews is also a really good way to switch, kind of switch your mindset back into conscious competence. And then I'm gonna just drop this. So if you're ever interested in my strong opinions about hiring, it gets a lot less clickbaity after the first paragraph. That's just there so people will continue reading it, because that's how you get people to read things on the internet. So in that prep phase, so when you're trying to teach someone else on a team, it's something that you're an expert at. Your job is pretty similar to if you're trying to teach yourself, but it becomes more about not forcing somebody who's totally lost to do all that legwork for themselves and removing all those distractions so they can focus just on the practice part. It's one of the reasons that having a good teacher can make you a lot better learner, even though like people who like to self-teach who struggle with staying humble about that, like to pretend that we can come anywhere close, can't. It's about removing those distractions. So you want to start by forming some objectives when you're trying to teach something you're an expert in. So what that can look like is forming some stories of what it looks like when somebody is an expert and what it looks like when somebody struggles. So an expert, JavaScript expert will probably be able to draw a picture of their application based on how their components are broken down and organized. Somebody who struggles, they might do trial and error code. Like just doing the next line, seeing if that does anything, not being really sure what's going to happen next. Or my favorite example is getting overwhelming when debugging because there's just too much information. I think these two are pretty common things for like a junior developer on a team to struggle with. And so you actually want to then break those stories down into sub-skills. So someone who can draw a picture of their application, the sub-skills of that might be you have to actually write modular code before you could draw a picture from memory. You might need some well-defined architecture. You might actually want to draw a picture before you start coding for how state transitions are going to work, rather than going and then drawing afterwards. For the negative stories, you flip them around. So somebody who no longer gets overwhelmed from debugging, they've gotten good at bisecting, splitting the code base into two, throwing out part as much possible source of problem as possible. And then using available tools, stuff like that. So you can actually break those down a lot further. But your job is to form those objectives for them because they are in that unconscious incompetence phase. They don't know what their objectives should be. So you breaking stuff down be really important. Now, on any team that's trying to teach newer members of that team, help them grow, something really important is to maintain a learning mindset. So part of your role as a teacher is not just to prep, not just to help them practice, but to help protect their mental state. And so that means a safe and positive learning environment. And that means something fairly specific. It doesn't mean you tell people they're right when they're not, but it does mean that it has to be safe for somebody to say something wrong. So reward or like celebrating a bad hypothesis or a wrong but well-formed hypothesis is a really good way to do that. So like getting excited that somebody's thinking along the right lines, even if they come to the wrong conclusion, that's one of those things. But But it's really important. Basically, all the learning science says that you just can't learn in a negative environment. Unfortunately for web folks like me, we're a notoriously opinionated bunch. Part of that means if we want to be a good teacher, we have to let go of some of our opinions because negativity about something makes you worse at learning it. People who have negative feelings about their native languages end up often worse speakers than people who learn it as a second language. Room to fail, like I said, celebrating well-formed but wrong hypotheses. And then this applies to development teams specifically that use Velocity, but actually any team. If your team is primarily obsessed with getting the next thing out the door, you will probably never have a safe learning environment. And so if that's the number one concern, then honestly, I'd say give up on trying to create a learning environment and maybe refocus your efforts to creating that environment before you try to teach people. Or if you're okay with an abusive relationship with Velocity, don't bring in new people who desperately need your help and won't get it. So deliberate practice for junior developers or new people to many areas. What that looks like specifically for junior devs, you have to let them work on features. You can't throw them at bugs. Bugs make people look at the wrong parts of the system. Oftentimes, it's based on things that are the wrong way, but rather than the right way, but really, like, they will never learn to write features only by fixing bugs. So like I said, really important to let them work on features. It's really important to let junior developers work on features. And then the other couple things, pair frequently in short sessions. I hate pairing because I'm secretly an introvert, and I just don't like anyone looking over my shoulder, and I don't like looking over someone else's shoulder and waiting for them to do stuff. The truth of the matter is pairing is really, really effective, especially for teaching. Now, that doesn't mean pair for 6 hours on something and say, okay, well, you understand the system now. It means like short bursts. Give them a chance to take a crack at a problem for a little bit, then pair with them on it. Or pair with them beforehand and talk through how they might approach it. And you want to poke them to explain their plan to you before they execute that plan, just so they're kind of talking. So it's like talking out pseudocode. And so your job as a senior or a teacher in prep, you gotta move back to your conscious competence. You want to define the specific outcomes before you start the practice, before you start throwing problems at someone. You need to know what you're trying to help them learn so you can find tasks that align with that, find features that align with those things. And selecting the right outcomes, figure out how to get them to practice. In a real-world scenario with a real code base, for instance, you might end up adjusting your outcomes because it turns out if you're thinking like vaguely what it looks like for someone to know JavaScript versus what it looks like for someone to be able to write JavaScript within the context of your team, you may actually have different outcomes. They may not need to know all the things that you would like someone who knows JavaScript to know, or knows in whatever you're teaching to know. Practice once again, let them write features. Pairing helps you keep that feedback loop really tight. Take your responsibilities very seriously, and remember that when you're serving this role as a teacher, you gotta once again let go of some of your opinions. Like, you're shifting into a different mindset. Your purpose has totally changed. One piece of advice I've given on that is you can still complain about things. You can still talk about the terrible parts of the system in non-constructive ways, but don't do it with the juniors. Do it with the other experts on the team. Find people who you don't have this obligation to. And then finally, mental state, help them remove distractions. So like that's helping them figure out what to do next. Maybe keeping them out of meetings that they aren't going to get a lot of benefit out of for a while. Be really positive and energetic. They have to. There's a Hitchcock quote at one point. One of his actresses said, I just I'm just not feeling, let's see, I just don't feel afraid. And Hitchcock said, I was going to take it. So even if you're like, oh, it's my job as a teacher, pretend I'm happy about this, go pretend to be happy about it, and then go hang out with the people who know how terrible it is and talk about them afterwards. And once again, always celebrate good hypotheses that prove wrong. And this is a really important thing here, and part of the reason it's important to let them work on features, but also part of why it's important to have a few ways, a few different branches people could possibly go down, but even more so why it's important to kind of, once you've helped them figure out how they're going to approach something, let them work on it, is we learn really effectively, not just by breaking stuff down into pieces, but to keep that motivation up, we have to have agency. We have to have some choice in it. We can't feel locked down into it. I think really this is the core of common set of complaints in a traditional education model, is how little choice there is in there. If you throw somebody at a subject area that they're not crazy about, but they still have some choice over it, oftentimes they will take to it a lot better. How can we help someone develop expertise in JavaScript or really any areas? Same way that you work to develop expertise in an area and develop a skill on your own, your role just changes. You're kind of becoming you're becoming like an extra brain for them, so they can just focus on doing that really frustrating bit, having that safety net, and not having to mix that in with what am I going to do next. Beyond the practical applications of this, this is kind of a different room than I think for a scientific mindset, things like this, I would think by and large kind of self-evident why this sort of thing is important. But beyond the practical application of it, we talked about how learning is to find meaning, and in Learn Better, Moser talks about how people who report high levels of meaning are all around better off, more satisfied with their lives, more healthy, less anxious. And I know there's a lot to deconstruct there, but the thing that I've said at a few tech conferences is if you're a fintech company, working in a bank, don't try to convince your development team that you're changing the world. You don't need to peddle in the doing great thing ideology for people to find meaning in what they're doing. Because learning is one way of finding meaning, and I would argue that a team that allows people to learn is actually giving people a chance at that spiritual satisfaction that a lot of companies, a lot of organizations, a lot of teams that they try to manufacture or approximate. I think honestly, maybe similar level to the sciences, like the more you specialize, and like the smaller kind of like little push out at the edge of knowledge you're making, it can be really demotivating if you start to think about like the velocity of knowledge that you're creating, like how fast you're going in that like direct task. Or you may think like, oh, well, I don't know how this is going into this bigger picture. So I think everybody at some point at that expert level ends up with a bit of an existential crisis. And it's worth remembering that going out of your way to learn, acquire new skills, and help others acquire skills is a really good way to find meaning, maybe long enough to get back to be really excited about the problem you're currently working on. Yeah, that's it. I end with that, with my equivalent of a mini sermon, I guess. But I'll send out, I say tweet, I'll email sharing a link to the slides and a book list. If you know anybody that works on the e-commerce team that is looking for UX research, check out Bainbridge.com. That's my current employer. I figure if enough people sign up through me giving this talk, that means they'll send me to conferences. Yeah, any questions?
questions from remote team? I'll start with, I have a couple, I made a couple notes while you were talking. At one point you said being an expert means assigning the right meaning to something. Is right binary? Is there right enough? Is there right enough for what you're trying to do? Or
yes. Ish. No, yes. I don't think it's really a binary. The thing I'll say on that is there are areas that the binary is more about learning the mental models that have over time been shown to be effective, especially in team environments where people are sharing mental models. So a lot of what I've talked about in the past with like making code and architecture decisions is they're not just about like the tool, but at kind of a meta level, like how does this work for sharing mental models across your team? I think one of the hard things about a lot of programming, I'd say especially web because of how fast it changes, that people are still kind of figuring out mental models. But I guess on the binary, the question of binary, maybe a good example for how that's not, like how the right models can be different times. The Bohr model of the atom is a really good incomplete model. And I guess on that same sort of thing, one of my underlying philosophies of teaching is and you've heard this already, but is that there are two ways to teach something. There's the math way and there's the physics way. The math way is you tell the truth all the time, but you tell only a little bit of truth at any given time. You build everything up, maybe ignoring when you do remainders for long division. But you're always telling the truth and you're using that over time to build a bigger picture. In physics, you lie about everything and slowly tell the truth. So nothing exists except for one-dimensional motion, then two-dimensional, maybe eventually friction. So same sort of way, like the right mental model changes based on context. Honestly, right is a super loaded word.
So maybe what you're saying is maybe being an expert is also knowing when to use the right model.
right, exactly.
Context.
Yeah, so that's actually a really good point because part of teaching is almost like code switching between different types of models. Like the models that I've used to develop an application are probably more complex than the model that I want to teach a brand new web developer. It doesn't need to know about like how individual pieces render, but it might still be helpful for them to think of a page as like initial view, event listeners, re-render kind of thing. So yeah, and that's also one of the reasons that having an expert to help guide learning can be really helpful is you can kind of check in and say like, you may come up with something that works, but you may also come up with something that's like way off base. So like, it leaves someone to their own devices for long enough and then figuring out what shape the earth is, they may come to the conclusion that it's flat and have a lot of great reasons for why it is. But in that case, they're not just the wrong reasons because they're the wrong reasons, but because like, what do you do with that information? Can you really do it? Can you really even create any new knowledge with an incorrect set of assumptions?
If you can pause that, I need to talk about batteries.
Oh yeah.
We can always cut. But
anyone want to ask a question while
we're
I have a question that you probably do want on the record.
Okay.
One sec here, let me get back to where we were at.
He probably asked you to cut to the recording.
Oh yeah, it's
screen recording is still going.
Okay. So what advice would you have for learners who may find themselves in a very suboptimal learning environment? And I'm asking this from the personal experience of having been turned off from programming for 5 years based on a couple of undergraduate Java courses that were readout courses designed to be procedurally hard for the sake of being hard rather than hard because the content is hard. And Java not being a great language, in my opinion, to sick your people on. It took me half a decade to recover from that, and here I am now as a developer, basically. But often you can be reading the wrong book, taking the wrong course, working on the wrong team, working in the wrong industry, and you could have a much better learning experience if you pivoted away from that. How do you recognize that you're in that kind of situation rather than just struggling learning?
Wow, that's...
I'm sorry.
No, there are a few questions there. Some of them get a big ol', I don't know. But some of them, let me digest this for a second. Okay, let me start with how to potentially compensate for a bad learning environment. So if it's something that you want to continue learning, but you don't want to quit, because I encourage people to quit more often than people tend to be comfortable with, partially because we're a society of like, winners never quit, quitters never win, but really like, there's an opportunity cost to everything. So don't be afraid to switch if it turns out that you're not crazy about what you're doing. It may even be the case that you want to come back to it later, but getting out earlier may keep you from being scarred. If you know this is what you want to do and you're not in the right environment to develop it and say you can't change that environment, which I think is a common problem for like an undergraduate degree, side projects can help. Finding somebody that you do respect and are excited by that is an expert in that area to give you some guidance, I think could be a potentially really good thing. Shoot, Hacky Hour and PhD are good examples of that kind of thing, of kind of breaking out of that normal bit. Let's see, had other ones. Before the last couple sub-questions. I will say I used to agree that the design was really bad of undergraduate computer science. Well, it is, because it's not. I think it's not really intentionally designed. I think it's a set of subjects and not a set of objectives and outcomes. But I don't think that, like, and I know you weren't literally saying there's a grand conspiracy to keep people out, but I think by and large it's...
They're incentives, I would argue.
Yeah, so I think there's an incentive against putting the effort into the earlier courses sometimes to make them really effective at teaching and really motivating, because like it's going to continue to be really hard, and some people see like helping people fail early as an advantage. I think the problem with a lot of weed out courses is it's the wrong kind of failing early. It's the scaring someone away with a bad example. Trying to think what the other questions were in there.
No, you hit the heart of what I was getting at. I can't be the only one who went through that kind of experience.
No, honestly, a ton of the instructors at the company I used to be at were instructors because they had that experience.
Yeah.
And like part of what drove me towards wanting to teach is just like, I want people learning to code to have a much better experience than I did. So maybe that's at a greater, more systemic level, maybe part of it is providing alternatives. But when you're in that, I don't know if I have an answer for when you're in that. I guess mine has always been find side projects or quit.
Okay. Thank you.
That's a good question. I like questions that I don't have a good answer to.
So I have a question coming from the other end. What advice can you give to somebody who may be in the unconscious competence area? Once upon a time, it's not you know, but there's so much of their ego is invested in being a senior developer. But they haven't had to fail, haven't had to feel like that uncomfort, discomfort of having to learn something new. How do you help people? What advice can you give, like, to as somebody who has to work with somebody like that, or somebody who is like that, who sees that in himself, He goes, ugh. And you're sort of, unless you're really aware that this is happening, you can just end up stagnating and sort of falling out of the industry because it's so challenging to your view of yourself to learn, yeah, to learn something new that is hard.
Yeah, so that's, yeah. I mean, I definitely have been at different points in my career where I've been like, I know what I'm doing, and this new tool's dumb because it's confusing. And I'm like, oh wait, now new tool's actually really good. I'm gonna cheat a little and throw away the hardest part of it, which is it's you can only really answer this for yourself because every part of this just does require that introspection. And you can't force someone else to see something differently. Now maybe a trick there is the same trick I'd say for someone to use on themselves. I think a really effective tool would be if you're thinking back on what you know, instead of just thinking back on a list of the self-tasks, taking something that you can do now, especially something that you take for granted is pretty easy. And then sitting down and trying to like journal through how you learned that, like what the first time you used that thing, like something that you can now do really easily. You may have beat your head up against it for 3 days and you may straight up forget it. So I think storytelling can be really effective there, like really taking a little memory time machine back to those early days and really thinking through your learning path. Honestly, technical interviews are probably a really good starter because I think that a lot of these are kind of two sides of the same coin, the imposter syndrome and like the ego of expertise, they're kind of built out of the same insecurity. The fear of feeling like you don't know or getting found out that you aren't who you seem to be, or all of those things kind of wrapped up in there. And something that technical interviews I think do pretty well is it's not like, oh, look at all these doofuses who are getting this wrong, I wouldn't get this wrong. It's the people who get close, but you can see like the way they're thinking about it, like fundamentally not even approaching the problem the right way, versus somebody who's approaching the problem well, not quite getting there, versus somebody who nails it. Oftentimes, if you've gotten a job and you're giving the same technical interview, your idea of what having done really well on it looks like totally changes. Like that was my experience. I thought there was a technical interview. I thought I tanked. Ended up getting the same one later on when I got hired at the company. I was like, oh no, I was a pass on this. I did pretty well. I didn't get the final answer, but that actually wasn't even the point of the exercise. So that's one thing. Maybe tutoring even at some level. So like less responsibility. But honestly, I think a lot of it is stepping outside of yourself. Being introspective and stepping outside of yourself are kind of the same thing.
Because you have mentioned before that a lot of people, the way that we learn things are very inefficient. Mm-hmm. And I think about the way that I learned programming, it was not really in a deliberate way.
Yeah.
It took very long. I probably could have done it in a quarter of the time much better and be a better programmer today if I'd been deliberate about it. But it was sort of haphazard, going from one thing to another. And so I don't know how I learned. I can't remember how I got to the point where it was, other than just many years. And that sucked. So I guess that, so maybe that time machine thing.
Yeah, and maybe honestly, I'm not comfortable with most sweeping generalizations, but I'm pretty comfortable saying, for any skill that you mostly self-taught, you should assume that you took a really efficient path and you should want something better for everybody else. I think there's even the some of the good instructors at Camden I was at had some problems with what I call like fetishizing the difficult days back when they were teaching themselves and everything was it was hard. It was like it's a different kind of there's frustration and then there's like grit. I liken it to when the mount level got dropped in World of Warcraft, and a lot of people who spent many, many hours on the game were really upset that newcomers to the game could get a mount quicker. And it's kind of a weird thing, right? We can kind of do the same thing about learning stuff. We want others to go through our same struggles. So maybe part of that can be getting excited about the fact that the thing I told my students was after a year, they're going to be way ahead of where I was after a year of programming. And that after a few years, they might be past me just because they've had better resources and they've had better chances to learn. And that's a scary thing as somebody puts time in. But the really exciting thing there is that also means that we can potentially end up with peers that make us better. Like we end up in a situation where we can learn. That's also hard because if you're used to feeling like the smart person in the room, it can sometimes even the most introspective of people can feel very afraid of suddenly having a lot to learn from the people in the room.
Thank you. Is there any questions from the people on the Zoom? Feel free to chime in now. Otherwise, going. Last chance.
No pressure. You want to check chat to make sure nobody's.
Actually, I can put a question in the meantime. Since you're talking about like smart people, maybe it's to just do things better. Like growth mindset versus like stagnant mindset, and like how that impacts learning.
Okay. So, the growth mindset's really hard. Personally, that our default mindset is not a growth mindset. This actually can go into. I've got some other ones that I like more, but I think the most common book that people cite with cognitive systems is Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman. I think it's Kahneman. The automatic versus reflective systems. We spend most of our life in our automatic systems. There's a good reason for that. If you need to swerve, you don't want to have to think about the mechanics of how you're going to swerve. Or when we're cavemen, if we think we hear a dangerous animal in the bushes, we don't want to go, I feel afraid. Why do I feel afraid? So we have to make a conscious effort to step out of that. And maybe this kind of goes actually into book Nudge about choice architecture and addresses the idea that not making a choice is often making a bad choice. So I think a learning mindset is such an active thing that if you're not constantly like working on being staying in a specific mindset, you are in a stagnant mindset. That eventually you plateau. And part of the reason I like teaching adults is that the adult learner brand new to a skill is actually pretty close to a stagnating expert in that they haven't had to feel those frustrations for a long time. So I had students who had done the same job for a decade and some of them really struggled with learning to program, not because of programming but people learning that. So they'd gotten good performance reviews every year. They felt like they're doing the same thing for a long time. They're really good at it. And unfortunately, that's like, it can be really hard to do something that feels bad after not doing something that feels bad for a really long time. So I guess I'd say like, it's not, and that three non-optional focuses, like really going out of your way to be in a learning mindset, or if you're teaching somebody, going out of your way to help them stay in a learning mindset. Telling them constantly that the frustration is the learning. and helping them maintain that positive attitude. Learning can't happen without that intentionality to it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks. Good day, everyone. Thanks for having me.